It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. The headline is that we won the war on smoking, but when you read the whole story, the picture changes. While overall smoking rates have declined dramatically since the 1960s, that mainly applies to middle and upper class Americans. The poor are still smoking and suffering the health consequences in increasing numbers. Do you currently smoke and come from a low-income family? If you've tried to quit but haven't been able to quite get over the finish line, what's the hardest part about quitting for you? Is it stress? Do a lot of other people around you smoke, making it harder to avoid? Tell us your story. Or maybe you previously smoked. How did you quit? Did your friends and family encourage and support you? Were you one of the few people at your job left smoking? And did the culture around your office help you quit? What was the key to quitting for you? Either way, tell us your story at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can join us by email. The address is ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry. Keith, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning.
At one point, poor Americans were slightly less likely to smoke than middle-class Americans. Tell us about when that was.
That would have been in the 1940s and 1950s. People who had higher education and higher income smoked a little more, probably because it was a habit that they could more easily afford. And it may also be because lower-income people tend to be more religious, and some religious people don't smoke. But as we've moved forward and we've done this terrific thing. You know, we've reduced smoking dramatically. It just hasn't been even. So although low-income people today smoke less than they did, 50 years ago, it's still the case today that almost three-fourths of smokers now live in low-income neighborhoods.
Okay, so once we learned about the health risks associated with smoking, how did people start changing their behaviors?
Well, a huge number of people just quit. They were probably not addicted, and we have to remember, doctors did ads for smoking. Smoking was not thought to be dangerous. So when the initial Surgeon General's report came out, a lot of people who weren't dependent on smoking sort of did it as a habit or socially just stopped. But that's the easiest, fruit to pick off the tree. Then people are left tend to be more dependent, and they had to work at it in lots of different ways. Some people sort of white-knuckled through it. Eventually, we developed things like the Nicorette gum and the patch and the lozenges, which helped more and more people quit. And then the last thing is we had a big social change. I mean, in the environment, we became less tolerant of smoking. We passed laws to make it harder to smoke. And we raised taxes on cigarettes. And all those things help push more people out of this deadly habit. That's terrific. But as I said, there's still some people left. Yeah.
Well, the statistics are, high-income families decreased their smoking by 62% from 1965 to 1999 versus only 9% for low-income families. And some of the things you mentioned that might be aids to quitting smoking, like the nicotine gum and so forth, the patch, those all cost money, and people may or may not have some kind of insurance that would help pay for it. Is that part of the problem here?
Yeah, it certainly is. And in fact, it's interesting, just in the election last week, I noticed, Idaho, Nebraska, Utah expanded Medicaid. And that's actually important, very relevant to this thing we're talking about, because if you're on Medicaid, it almost always covers nicotine replacement therapy, maybe some brief counseling. But if you don't have that and you don't have insurance through work, you just have to, try to quit on your own. Some people can do that, but it's way, way harder. Particularly if you're really addicted, than when you don't have that access to those medications. So that puts poor people who are trying to quit at a disadvantage against people who have insurance.
And in Wisconsin, the government applied for a federal waiver in order to, among other things, have people who smoke pay a premium basically for Medicaid in the state, so that would make it even more difficult for those folks to deal with some of the health problems associated with smoking. Is that kind of thing common around the country, or was that something uniquely Wisconsin?
I'm not aware of other states that have done that, and it's one of those things that, independent how one feels about it ethically, I suspect economically, we're actually much better off having smokers have access to Medicaid, because when you stop smoking, you're far less likely to get cancer, have a heart attack, have a stroke, and those conditions are extraordinarily expensive and almost always in some ways fall on the public purse, even if it's just people showing up in emergency rooms. So you're probably better off. That's probably one of those economies that isn't an economy, and it'd be cheaper just to let people have the coverage.
Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at Stanford University's Department of Psychiatry. Let's take a call here. Ian is with us in Milwaukee. Ian, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. So I smoked. I'm a young guy, but I'm 25 now, and I stopped smoking about a year ago. I smoked for 2 years. Couldn't even really tell you why I started, but it's not something I wanted to do, but I just found myself addicted like a lot of people do. And my girlfriend absolutely hated it. She convinced me to get like one of those handheld, like electronic vaporizers where you put the oil in with mm-hmm. the nicotine. And so I tried that and I was using it a lot. And she definitely preferred it. I definitely preferred it. And then, you know, what you can do with those is you put less and less nicotine in the oil, but I didn't even need to do that. I just found myself smoking that less and less, and now I don't smoke at all. So I know we're talking about income here. I know those things can kind of be an investment. Mine was about $50. But if you do that, I mean, that helps me a lot. I'd recommend people try that.
Ian, thanks for sharing that. Keith, you boil the discrepancy in behaviors down to several reasons. The first is that lower-income smokers take longer and deeper drags on each cigarette than middle- and high-income families. Tell us about that and maybe comment on how Ian changed his behavior.
Well, I would say congratulations to Ian. That is terrific. I'm happy for him and his girlfriend and you know, the step down seems, you know, that's what a lot of people need because the withdrawal is very intense, particularly the first couple weeks can just be rotten. So, you know, he did it with a vape product. That's terrific. Other people take that step as well. And, you know, vaping's not good for us, but it's way better for us than a combusted cigarette. So that's certainly terrific. But anyway, you know, people who are lower income, yeah, may on average be more addicted. So, you know, take deeper drags, tend to smoke the cigarette down to the very last, all the way down to the filter, pick up a used cigarette and relight it, that sort of thing. All of which, you know, suggests that they're going to be more dependent on nicotine, and that's the, you know, key reason why it's so tough to quit smoking. So they often need the support, the kind of support, you know, Ian got through that product to quit.
Let's just momentarily talk about the problem of nicotine addiction, because I know somebody who was a recovering alcoholic and had been a four-pack-a-day smoker for decades who told me that there wasn't a day that went by he didn't crave a drink, but not an hour that went by that he didn't crave a cigarette. How powerful is nicotine addiction?
You know, I've had a similar experience. I've asked a number of people, you know, who've been patients who have quit multiple drugs, what's the hardest one? And it's very common that they say tobacco, even people who quit serious alcohol problems, cocaine problems, and heroin problems. So it is extremely addictive. But the good news is that, you know, the most damage that you get from a cigarette is not the nicotine directly, but it's all the tars and things and carcinogens that you inhale. So if it turns out that somebody can't break the nicotine habit, but they can at least break the smoking tobacco habit, and they, mm-hmm. they end up being on the patch for a long time, their health is way better off than it would be if they kept, you know, lighting up.
Lower-income people also more likely to smoke than their higher-income counterparts, you say, because of who they work with and live around. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Yeah, I mean, when I moved out from the Midwest to California and at the hospital at lunchtime, I remember seeing all these people are wearing gym clothes and stretching, and I'm like, what's going on here? It's like, oh, they all go running here in California. They all exercise at lunch in California. Very soon, I was doing the same thing. And it's a very common experience. I mean, when we want to change health behavior, it's what are the people around us doing? You know, if you want to diet, join a group that they're all working together to diet. Well, ditto if you want to quit smoking. It helps a lot if you're around people who don't smoke who are also trying to quit smoking. Well, for me, that's easy. As a middle-class person, hardly anyone I know smokes. I hardly ever see a cigarette. But there are places, you know, if I you know, if you work in a, you know, the washing dishes in a restaurant, you can be in the opposite situation where everyone's smoking. You're offered a cigarette. You smell cigarettes. That makes it really tough to quit. You got all the cues there. You got the social pressure there. And also sometimes smoking is how people relax together. So that makes it just tougher to stop. I mean, smoking is really, you know, it's like a snowball going downhill. As your friends quit, as your neighborhood quits, it gets easier and easier and easier. But when they haven't, it's harder and harder and harder.
Well, the counseling advice given to anybody who's addicted to something is that you have to change your surroundings so that you're not around what it is you're addicted to. So that makes perfect sense from that standpoint. This shouldn't be a surprise to anyone that this is true, I guess, is what I'm saying, right?
No, it is true that if you want to make a change, having people support the change, you know, family, friends, and so on, it makes it easier. But it's hard, you know, it can be hard to switch out. You know, what if you're people at work you're really close to, you like, and the way they hang out is they have a smoke break each day. It makes it tough unless you can convince them all, which sometimes happens. Let's all try to quit smoking together. Sometimes that works.
How does access to healthcare impact the probability that you'll be a smoker?
If you are, you know, most people who are left smoking today are pretty addicted. I mean, all the people who are shaped by information, social pressure, have quit. So you have a pretty hardcore group of people. And having access to, you know, nicotine replacement products of any sort is going to roughly double the odds any quit attempt is going to succeed. So if you don't have that and you're just kind of, you know, white knuckling it, sometimes people do it. There's no doubt that they do it. But it sure is a lot harder. Very easily get in this habit. I mean, even people who succeed quitting smoking have tried and failed on the average about half a dozen times before. It's a tough habit to break.
We're talking about how our likelihood of smoking is tied to our socioeconomic status. The shorthand for that is the poor smoke more than the rich. Keith Humphreys is with us and stays with us. I'm John Munson. Our conversation continues on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Your socioeconomic status is a strong indicator of whether you'll be a smoker or not. In other words, our sharp decline in tobacco use overall in America comes with an asterisk. If you smoke, have you tried quitting? Do you have access to the kinds of support programs that you need in order to quit? Do you have a family member who's tried to quit smoking? And do you think increasing cigarette taxes is a way to curb tobacco use? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry. Keith, we had an email from John in Madison who wants to know if there's a difference between chewing tobacco and smoking it from a health perspective. Keith, do we have any data on whether there is also a class difference in chewing tobacco like there is in cigarettes?
Yeah, chewing tobacco was always more popular among lower income and upper income people in the United States. And you have different risks from the two things. I mean, so if you are you have the tobacco in your mouth, that puts you at higher risk for oral cancers, but you have a lower risk of lung cancer. And for a smoker, that'd be the other way around because you're pulling that, you know, the carcinogens deep into your lungs.
And what role do you think stress plays in one's likelihood to smoke or not?
Well, you know, it is. I mean, the thing about all things to which we get addicted is they feel good in the short term. And one of the ways they feel good is that they can relieve any stress that we're feeling. And virtually everyone who smokes will tell you that. Even if they, say in the end, I know this is bad for me, and I hate the way I feel when I get up in the morning. At least at the moment, particularly when things are difficult, I enjoy that cigarette. And broadly speaking, you know, there are exceptions, but broadly speaking, it's, daily stress is a more common thing when you're living on the economic margin than when you feel secure in your, you know, economic situation and your life situation. So you could certainly imagine that would make it more attractive to start smoking and also harder to quit smoking if you're in a situation where you're economically struggling and under stress day to day.
And do tobacco companies market their products to the poor more than to other groups of people?
Yes, they do. And that is another really important difference between poor and middle-class communities. Anyone can see if they just, you know, walk through an example of each. Far more, you'll see far more advertising, both, outside stores, but inside stores, like, you know, in the little convenience shops, that kind of thing. There'll be ads all over the place. And there's also just more places to buy tobacco in lower-income neighborhoods than there are in middle-class neighborhoods. And that makes it easier to keep going. I mean, if everybody had to drive, you know, 10 miles to get a cigarette, that would make people more likely to quit or less likely to initiate the habit. But when it's everywhere and it's very easy to do, that makes it really easy to continue the habit. And if you're also trying to quit and you're in that struggling phase, particularly where it's quite unpleasant, and then you look around and you see an ad of, you know, attractive person smoking, that raises your desire even more. You go into the store to buy milk and there's, you know, cigarette ads all over the store. Again, that's, you know, can easily trigger you to think, okay, I'm going to break down and buy another pack.
And what about the role of cigarette taxes in helping people reduce their smoking? Have we seen whether or not these are effective? I mean, some of them are quite high. In New York City, for example, with the tax, a pack of cigarette costs more than $10 these days. Do we know that this works, or does this just make life harder for poor people?
Well, you know, it does help enormous numbers of people quit. It also probably helps even more people to avoid picking up the habit in the first place because they don't want to, you know, pay the cost of it. The group that's the most sensitive to price tend to be young people, you know, because they have less disposable income, but also that'd be true of low-income people. The other question you're raising is, you know, gets to be a social justice question. At some point, if taxes get extraordinarily high, are we just punishing low-income smokers? And I think that, you know, that is a legitimate question. I'm more worried about the fact that, you know, in the states with a fair amount of low-income people and in a strong tobacco industry, taxes are still ridiculously low. I mean, there's plenty of places where, you know, taxes are 50 cents a pack, 75 cents a pack, places like Virginia, West Virginia, and they have extremely high rates of smoking. So, you know, bringing those up would probably produce a lot of public health gains.
Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry. We've seen that the opioid crisis is hitting poor communities the hardest. Is there any link between nicotine addiction and other types of addiction?
We're not aware of that, but I think a far more likely link you may see more in the future is marijuana and tobacco. Marijuana use is very similar to tobacco use in terms of the profile. About 80 to 85% by volume is consumed by people who didn't go to college, didn't graduate college. And it's smoked, of course, and some people smoke cannabis and tobacco together. So one possibility, as we, you know, are developing a legal industry and we're having a lot of promotion, as you'll see, an alliance between the tobacco and the cannabis industries, maybe to push back on any smoking laws or just to sort of make smoking normal again. And that, I think, is the biggest risk of a revival of tobacco via that route of marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call here. Carol joins us from Madison. And Carol, we're starting to get short on time here.
Okay, it'll just be just a second. I just want to quick tell you how tobacco use is so addictive. I've been a smoker for about 45 years, not a super heavy smoker. In 2011, I had a heart attack, and I just still, like, I quit for like 6 months, and then I went back to smoking. And I continued to smoke, and by 2012, in order to, you know, it encouraged me to get on the heart transplant and list, heart transplant list, and in 2012, I quit. By 2014, I had a heart transplant, which I am so happy that I had quit and that I have now a new heart and I have mm-hmm. something to live for. But I was at the point where I only had a couple months to live.
So it was a life and death situation for you, Carol. Thanks for sharing your story. So Carol's an example of somebody who had to try several times to quit, and it required a life-altering event to finally get her over the top. How common is that?
It's actually quite common, and you know, and a large number of people quit smoking after a heart attack, but still, a bare majority keep on smoking, which I think attests to the incredible addictiveness of the product. And you just got to keep trying. I mean, it can be discouraging, but you got to keep at it. You eat, no matter how long you've been at it, if you can quit smoking, your health's going to be better.
For the non-smokers listening who don't think this affects them, what would you say?
Oh, you know, we are all affected by each other's health, whether we want to be or not. I just see this. We're all in this together. You know, when you go in, when you seek the ER and you want care quickly, you're affected by how many other people are having heart attacks or having strokes or had an accident and so on. And a lot of that is driven by things like smoking or drinking or other types of things. So we really are, you know, you're better off in a self-interested way. In addition, I think in a humane way, to want to try to help people quit smoking, even if their economic situation is drastically different than your own.
We got about a minute left here. If we want to see smoking rates decline among the poor, what's our most effective course of action here?
Well, the fact that, as we talked earlier, you know, three states have expanded Medicaid further. A number of other states did so a few years ago under the Affordable Care Act. But there's still a lot of states, and they tend to be low-income states with lots of smokers, that haven't expanded Medicaid. So that'd be a very good investment for states that want to, you know, help people break this habit. And I think they'll be very happy they did, not just in terms of the health, but economically. The burden on the public purse is actually less when people quit smoking versus ending up with lung cancer or having a heart attack or stroke.
And cigarette taxes?
Cigarette taxes are highly effective. Those states that have low taxes should really consider raising them up, to the national mean, yeah.
Keith Humphreys, thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
Keith Humphreys is a psychiatry and behavioral sciences professor and director of mental health policy at the Stanford University Department of Psychiatry. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.